Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
It is November the 23rd, and we are in Ezra. We are in Perek Beis, Chapter 2, and Mrs. Kaiser says that we're up to Pesach Samach Vav 66, which looks correct to me as well.
Okay.
Okay. The we are still counting we were just counting the people who were coming up for building the second Beis HaMikdash, who came with Yehoshua Kohen Gadol and with Zerubbabel, and now we're going to list their animals as well, which is interesting to me. The most interesting part is which animals the numbers of animals, which ones relatively, which ones are more, which ones were less. So let's read them through. It's not that many psukim. Suseihem shvameos shloshim v'shisha. Their horses were 736. Pir dehem, their mules, masayim abrayim v'chamisha, 245. Gmalehem, their camels, abameos shloshim v'chamisha, 435. Chamorim, their donkeys, sheshes alafim shvameos v'esrim, 6,720. I thought that was interesting, that a greatly disproportionate number of donkeys compared to the other animals. Don't know why, but it's interesting.
Carry all those vessels.
What's that?
Carry all those vessels.
Yeah, but a mule is also a pack animal, right? Mm-hmm. It could be because they weren't able to breed them. You couldn't make a mule. Jews aren't allowed to do that. Some say even non-Jews aren't allowed to do that. So it could be that's the reason.
I would think the horses would have had a very hard time getting through that kind of terrain.
Could be. The camels would have been better suited. Yeah. Umerashe ha'avos, and from the heads of the families, the heads of the heads of households, b'volam beis Hashem asher b'Yerushalayim, when they came to the house of Hashem in Yerushalayim. Now, of course, there was no house of Hashem in Yerushalayim at this time, but they came to the place of the house of Hashem in Yerushalayim. Hisnadvu, they made pledges, Labeis Ho'elokim, to the house of God, Lahamidah Mechono, to establish it on its foundation, or its, yeah, I guess its foundation. Mm-hmm. So they pledged money to help with the construction.
How would they know who the head of the father's houses are if some of them didn't know who their father was?
Yes, some they didn't know. But we had before, there were several families that were clearly the families that knew who they, knew who they were. They were prominent families. Kikocham nasnu la'otza melacha, according to their strength, which means according to their means, they gave to the treasure house of the work, to the treasurer, zahav, gold, darkmonim, sheish ribos va'elef. A darkmon was a type of coin. Somebody said it's a gold coin. One second. What did I see? It's a gold coin.
It says in the English of gold, comma, 61,000 darkmons, and then it's semicolon, and then of silver, how much? And it's another name for that.
Okay. So it was a gold. I mean, the Ibn Ezra says it explicitly that it was a gold coin, and there were, as you said, 61,000. V'chesef manim chameshas alafim, and silver manim, that's another type of coin, 5,000. V'chasnos kohanim emeah, and the tunics of the Kohanim, 100. People donated that as well for the Kohanim to wear.
So they were made by someone. They were ordered from someone.
I'm not sure. We're going to see presently that they were not able to wear the clothing that they would use to serve in the Beis HaMikdash when they were not doing the service in the Beis HaMikdash. No. They can only wear it at that time. So I'm not sure if this refers to what the Kohanim wore when they served, or what the Kohanim wore when they were not serving. Mm-hmm. So we'll see in a minute that there's a difference between the two.
Should be some kind of special.
There's no question they were special. If they were, there's no question. But there are four garments, and it's not just the tunic. Mm-hmm. And it's not, there's no mention of the other ones. That's why I'm not sure if this is meant to be the priestly garments that are mentioned in Parshas Tetzaveh and the Chumash. And the Kohanim and the Levim and from the nation and the those who were the Levim who were singers and those who were gatekeepers, the Nesinim and those who were the Nesinim. Remember, those are the ones who were from the Givonim who had tricked Yehoshua, and they were made to be water drawers and wood choppers, right? Be'arehem, they dwelled in their cities. Bechol Yisrael be'arehem, and all the Jews in their cities. So what happened is they came up from Bavel, and they did not immediately converge on Yerushalayim. Even though the purpose of their coming up from Bavel was to rebuild the Beis HaMikdash, which of course has to take place in Yerushalayim, that was not the first stop. First, everybody dispersed to their various cities. Now, the reason for this is, I imagine, I don't know with certainty, but I imagine the reason is because they had to establish where they were going to live. Because they were not coming up to Yerushalayim. We know in retrospect that what ended up happening is that the work started, was stopped, and the people essentially came back to Bavel. I don't know if everybody came back to Bavel, but most of them came back to Bavel. They were unable to continue the work. So this re-establishment of Eretz Yisrael was short-lived. But they didn't know that. And they thought they were coming up not only to build the Beis HaMikdash, but to re-establish the Jewish presence in Israel, meaning living in their cities and creating a self-sufficient economy with all of the infrastructure that we know that Jews need to live, including shuls and schools and mikvahs and eruvs and bakeries and pizza shops and whatever else are the essential parts of Judaism. So that's what they were doing here. They were reestablishing everything in preparation for the long haul. They're not going to be here for a long period of time, and they of course have to rebuild the Beis HaMikdash and then live there. So they first went to their cities to basically move in. And then they're going to go to Yerushalayim. Now, when they go to Yerushalayim, it's not going to take that long. They're not going to sit and, you know, build mansions and then go to Yerushalayim. They're going to simply drop off their bags, get themselves settled, and then go to Yerushalayim to help with the building. And that's where we get into the next perek, Perek Gimel, chapter 3, where they begin the building in earnest. So the pasuk says, "Vayigah haChodesh haShvi'i," and it came the seventh month. Now, it never told us when they went up. So it's hard now to give it a context, because it says they came in the seventh month. Well, what month did they leave for Yerushalayim? And if I remember correctly, it never told us a specific month. It just said it was the first year of Koresh. In the beginning of this Sefer, that's what it said, it was the first year of Koresh's reign. And he said, you can go up. But it never told us the month. So it's hard to know how long did this take. Now, the trip itself took a long time, as we know. Traveling in those days was not a simple matter. And once they got there and they had to go to their cities first and get settled, how long did that take? Again, it's not clear. But whatever it is, when they got to the seventh month, then, as we're going to see, they came to Yerushalayim. Now, what's in the seventh month? Which month is the seventh month? Tishrei. Tishrei, of course, has Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, and Sukkot. So, for that very significant month, they came to Yerushalayim. So, came the seventh month. Uvenei Yisrael be'arim, the Jews were in their cities. Ve'yasfu ha'am, and the nation gathered, ki ish echad, like one man, el Yerushalayim to Yerushalayim. So, they were united in purpose, and they all converged on Yerushalayim in the seventh month. Vayakam Yeshua ben Yotzadok ve'echav haKohanim, and Yeshua ben Yotzadok and his brothers the Kohanim got up, and he is the Kohen Gadol, Yehoshua Kohen Gadol. Uzrubavel ben Shealtiel ve'echav, and Zrubavel, the son of Shealtiel, and his brothers, remember Zrubavel is Nehemiah, and he is a descendant of Yehuda of David HaMelech, so he also is there. They get up. Vayivnu es mizbach Elokei Yisrael, And that what's the very first thing that they build? You come to Yerushalayim. You have a free hand. The king has given you the freedom to rebuild the Beis HaMikdash. So what's the very first thing that you build? The first thing they built was the Mizbeach, the altar. They built the altar of Hashem to bring up upon it sacrifices. And Ola is a sacrifice that is completely burnt, that is completely consumed by the fire. There's nothing that's eaten by the people or by the Kohanim. Kakasuv, as it is written, Besoras Moshe Isho Elokim, in the Torah of Moshe, the man of God. So why build the Mizbeach first?
To thank Hashem for being able to rebuild.
So how does that thank Hashem?
Because you're offering a sacrifice.
Okay, so it's in order to offer sacrifices, which would thank Hashem. Okay? Any other suggestions?
Wasn't it Lot who... What did he do? He put in an altar first, and then he... Or is it the reverse? Is there some connection to him here?
Lot?
No, Lot, maybe Noah.
Noah?
He offered sacrifices and then built a vineyard. Okay, planted a vineyard. So he's done what they have done here, Noah.
Okay.
Right?
Okay, so the first thing
there
he does is they build it. I don't know.
Are they going to build a vineyard soon?
No. No. They won't get to that. Yeah.
Did we have already mikvahs yet?
Did we have? When they went to settle in their cities, they must have built that as well. In those days, building a mikvah was not the to-do that it is today, because they weren't as nice. They didn't have the amenities that mikvahs have today. The beautiful mikvah that we have here in town, and I got my first tour of the mikvah very recently. So,
really?
Yeah.
Wow.
So anyway, it is a very beautiful mikvah. So the what we have today, Baruch Hashem, in the way of mikvahs, in those days it was a hole in the ground, you know, with some steps, and it wasn't and it was cold. And it was not a pleasant experience.
But isn't that what you need in order to
what's that?
Isn't that what you need in order to enter the
Yes, you need it. You're pointing out you'd have to become pure before, not just the women, the men, everybody would have to become pure before entering the Temple Mount. That is true.
So why would they build that?
They would have, but that was included in settling in their cities.
Maybe they knew the place where the Mizbeach should be, and then they could measure the walls.
Okay, so you're suggesting it was a
good starting point.
Right. It was a
center point.
Yeah.
Focal
point.
First, focal. And then to
right.
Yeah.
Right.
Measure.
So from a
structural
architectural standpoint. Thank you. Right. So then they would use the Mizbeach as a way of then focusing themselves, but they don't really need a Mizbeach for that. They do need the place of the Mizbeach.
Yeah,
that's true.
That's
but you don't need the Mizbeach itself. But you're right that the you're bringing up a very important point, which is the place of the Mizbeach is very, very important. We're going to get to that in a moment.
I would think that wouldn't they have to be cleansed spiritually before they could even build the Kodesh Kodoshim? Like you'd have to be.
True. But yeah. Why do you need? You're suggesting you need a Mizbeach in order to become. Pure?
Well, they don't know if they've had sins in the past or right because of all of this. It's questionable. So, isn't there like a carbon that you give it?
Yes. Yeah.
Or
but
unintentional sin.
Yes. Yes. There are carbonos that you could bring in those situations, but you don't need that in order to become pure to build. To become pure to build, you need a mikvah, and you might need the ashes of a paraduma, the red heifer. That you might need also. That's a separate question. But they
did they have those
things? It does not say that they did.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, it says here, you know, as is written in the law of Moses, the man of God, which makes me think that it said when you go into Israel, you should not make an offering wherever you feel like it.
Correct.
It should only be in the place.
Okay. So this
so
way
they know that they can't do it.
They can't do it anywhere else. So if they're going to offer sacrifices, it's got to be here.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think they said they built the altar right away, and then it says that they set the altar upon spaces.
Right, that's going to be the next verse.
Yeah, I know, but what I read ahead. Just
yeah,
a little
yeah,
bit.
Yeah.
But I mean that's curious to me. So right, we're not there yet, but I think that the altar had to be built right away because that was the most important thing that they were supposed to do. First,
okay.
they honored God. Then they could continue on with settling in, you know,
okay.
preparing to build, and that this was penultimate and
okay, so that's
their purpose.
It appears that that's the case, that the Mizbeach is the most important part, or at least the most time-sensitive thing to do, is to put up that Mizbeach.
When does someone make an Olah normally? For what
so, okay, good. So that really zeroes in on the issue. See, the thing is that we have a commandment in the Torah that we are not able to do a daily commandment that we're unable to do because we don't have a Mizbeach, and that is the Karban Tamid, and that is the daily sacrifice, which is about one in the morning, one in the evening, and in the afternoon, I should say. And that those sacrifices, from the time the Jews got the Torah until the time of the destruction of the first Beis HaMikdash, which is over 800 years, was never stopped. It was a constant thing. It's supposed to be constant. It says Tamid, constant. You do it all the time. And therefore, that became the most important thing to get started as soon as possible. It now had been stopped for many years, depending on how you count the years, etc. But it was stopped for many years, and now they wanted to start it as soon as possible, and then continue on forever. So, of course, they were not able to continue on forever. They were, the construction was stopped. But they wanted to begin the sacrifices as soon as they possibly could. It therefore follows from here, as you realize, that you don't need the rest of the Beis HaMikdash in order to offer sacrifices. All you need is the Mizbeach, is the altar. And since the Mizbeach itself, the altar, which definitely has dimensions of its size and its shape and all that, but as with everything, you're going to have the optimal size and shape, and then you're going to have the size and shape that is the least that you can get away with and still be kosher. So as soon as you get up whatever you can that is kosher, you can then start offering sacrifices. For example, the menorah. The menorah in the Beis HaMikdash was made out of what material?
Gold.
It was made out of gold. But it doesn't have to be made out of gold. It is the optimal material that is made out of gold. But it doesn't have to be made out of gold. According to some opinions, it can be made out of wood and still be kosher. Mm-hmm. Everybody holds it doesn't have to be gold, and some say even wood would be okay. When the Chashmonaim came back in the time of Hanukkah and rededicated the Beis HaMikdash, they, according to the Gemara, they made a makeshift menorah. They didn't just not have oil. They didn't have a menorah either that was usable. But the menorah was solvable without pure oil. All you needed to do was put something together in a makeshift way in the least possible necessary materials and that they had. But the oil, they needed pure oil. That's why you have the miracle of Hanukkah. So here, they were able to quickly put together a mizbeach, an altar, that was acceptable enough to begin the sacrifices. This then leads to a discussion which today is somewhat theoretical, but it hasn't always been theoretical, which is, can we offer sacrifices today? Can sacrifices be offered today? You see, you don't need the rest of the Beis HaMikdash to offer sacrifices. The Mizbeach, the altar, was located on the Temple Mount, on the Har HaBayis, but it was not in the building of the Beis HaMikdash. It was, of course, inside the walls of the Beis HaMikdash, but it was in the open-air area. It wasn't in the actual building itself. The building with the roof had the menorah. It had the shulchan, the table, with the lechem apanim, with the bread. It had the small mizbeach, the small altar that was used for ketores, for incense. And it also had, of course, in the Kodesh HaKadoshim, in the Holy of Holies, it had the Ark, the Aron, which in the second Beis HaMikdash they didn't have. So those things were all inside the building. But the Mizbeach was open air. Mm-hmm. And you know this anyway because the Mishnah says that one of the daily miracles that took place in the Beis HaMikdash was that... What's that?
That it didn't
The smoke went straight up from the altar, and the wind did not blow it or disperse it all over the place. It was a straight, even though it was open air. So the rain came down and the wind blew, but it didn't hurt the altar. It didn't hurt the mizbeach. It was open air though. So you don't need a building in order to put up the mizbeach. Now, if that's so, then in theory, if we Jews would be able to have enough control or power over the Temple Mount, could we offer sacrifices? Today it would cause a war. But in theory, is that acceptable or not? And this was a major debate that took place in the 16th century. Yes?
Well, can't the Tommy not go onto our bias in the first?
Yes.
So how is that even...
You mean today? How could we do today? Or you're asking about them?
No, but then we say that they somehow will tar themselves.
Right.
But nowadays...
So we can also become tar. We can become pure. We can go to the mikvah. The only thing we don't have is the parah aduma, is the red heifer. So there we have a rule that tumas meis, which is the impurity of coming in contact with a dead body, is hutra betzibur. That for the congregation, if most of the congregation is impure and unable to become pure, then that we can offer a sacrifice even if we don't have the ashes of the parah aduma. So there are dispensations for that. The Gemara speaks about that even when there is a Beis HaMikdash, there is such a dispensation. So in theory, one should be able to offer sacrifices. So as I said, in the 16th century, this became a major debate. Apparently they had some ability to get up on the Temple Mount, and there was a discussion about sacrifices. In the 16th century, there was a discussion about reestablishing the Sanhedrin. That's a mistake I just made. But more recently, there's been a debate about reestablishing the sacrifices. Yes?
I think the reason that we can't make sacrifices is because over time, we lost an intimate connection to Hashem.
Okay.
So we don't, since we, the connection is not broken, but say that it's
okay.
Thinned out.
Okay.
And thinned.
So there is actually, that may be true, but there's actually a more practical problem than that. There's more, besides the fact that the Arabs are there, but there's a more practical problem.
Do we know exactly where Kohanim, you'd have to be sure that it was Kohanim, but there are some who do have the...
Okay, so who's a Kohen? That's an important question, because Kohanim... Today we are working with chazaka. We're working with a presumption that a person's a kohen because their father was a kohen, etc. But we don't know for certain. And there are definitely stories today where a person discovers that they thought they were a kohen and they're really not. We've had that. But there are people who can trace their lineage all the way back. But you want to repeat
where
that?
Where do we stop?
Okay.
Where's the kodesh kodeshim? Where does it stop?
Or more importantly, where is the mizbeach? Right. See, the mizbeach has to be in a specific place. It has to be in a specific place, and this is an issue about where should the Mizbeach go. The Gemara says that there were three prophets that came up with the Jews, the last three of the prophets, Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi. Those three prophets are the last prophets of the Jewish people, meaning until, of course, Mashiach comes, but for the time being, they're the last ones that we've had. And they, one of them, told them where the exact spot is for the Mizbeach, for the altar. And because of that, they were able to build one and offer sacrifices. Another one of them told them that they're allowed to offer sacrifices without the Beis HaMikdash. Yeah. That all you need is the altar and you're able to do it. So they had the leadership that knew enough information to enable the offering of sacrifices. The problem today primarily is that we don't know where it is. We don't know the exact location of the Mizbeach. Now, in theory, if we did know, perhaps there'd be another problem having to do with our connection to Hashem, etc. But the practical issue right now would be, where is the exact place of the Mizbeach? Now, you can do archaeological digs, and you can try to figure it out, and you may be able to pinpoint it, but it is by no means something that is agreed upon today exactly where the Mizbeach was.
Well, how did they know? So this to me goes back to the connection with God, with Hashem. How did they know where to put it?
You're exactly right, because it was a prophet who told them, who was connected to Hashem. Right, exactly, exactly. So the lack of connection to Hashem leads to a practical problem, which is, where is it?
Yeah. Didn't they build altars though before this? Didn't they have sacrifices before? So that was because there was. Can you explain that?
So the Torah allows for private altars, a backyard altar. Yeah. The Torah allows for that up until the building of the Beis HaMikdash. Once the Beis HaMikdash was built, the first Beis HaMikdash was built, backyard altars are prohibited.
But did that actually sacrificed animals on those altars? They
yeah.
just made a fire.
No. All altars were animals. All of them.
Another thing, isn't there a chromosome that they've just identified with the Kohanim? Is that not a...
They think. How do they prove it? They're taking.
They all have it.
Assuming.
How do you know that they're
them?
Wasn't Shiloh a public one?
Yes, Shiloh was a public one. What happened is when the Jews came up, when we first got the Torah, so the Mishkan was the altar. That was the Mishkan. At that time, you could not have a backyard. It's called a bama. A private altar is called a bama. So you can't have a backyard bama. Right? Once we got to Israel, and then they put the Mizbeach, they put the altar in Gilgal first. Mm-hmm. At that time, you could have your own altar. Then it was put into Shiloh, and at that time you could not have your own altar. When Shiloh was destroyed, and then the Mizbeach first moved to Nov and then to Givon, then you could have your own altar. So it kept going back and forth, depending on where the Mizbeach was. But once the Mizbeach gets to Yerushalayim,
That's it.
And forever after, you can't make your own altar. So they couldn't do it. They could only do it, and we can only do it, on the right place. So there may be other issues as well, but this is an issue. Where is the exact spot where the Mizbeach is supposed to go?
So who here is actually pinpointing that?
There were, as I said, there were prophets with them.
Not Yirmiyahu or any of them.
Well, he was also a prophet, but the Gemara says it was Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi. One of those three.
There's a question. Was that answer to that question purposely hidden by?
It's very possible. See, it's very possible that because of your point, therefore Hashem allowed this practical problem to creep up. That he wouldn't let them know where it was because it wasn't a time for sacrifices. That could be. In their day, evidently Hashem wanted the sacrifices, so he allowed the place to be known. Pasuk Gimel, verse 3. Vayachinu hamizbeach al mecho nosav. They established the mizbeach on its foundations. Ki ve'ema aleihem me'ameh haratzos. For they were in fear from the nations around them. So, what is this giving a reason for? We'll say in a moment what that has to do with. Vayalu alav olos l'Hashem. They brought up on it olos, totally burnt sacrifices to Hashem. Olos la boker v'la arev, olos in the morning and in the evening. That's the daily sacrifice. The daily sacrifice is an ola. The tumid is an ola. That's the type of sacrifice that it is, and they would bring it every morning and every evening. Now they were afraid of the nations around them. So the different commentaries, the different mefarshim, suggest different reasons for why what this line means. They were afraid about them, and therefore what? So many of the commentaries say that that's why they waited until they had gathered all together in Yerushalayim before establishing the Mizbeach. They didn't right away put up the Mizbeach because since people were scattered, they weren't in force. They didn't. All 40,000 of them were not in Yerushalayim. Once they converged on Yerushalayim and now they had a critical mass, now they felt secure enough to put up the Mizbeach. That's what some of the commentaries say. Others say the reverse, that because they knew that the nations around them would be hostile and not interested in them rebuilding, they wanted to show that they have the permission of the king of Koresh, that they were under the protection of the crown. And so they offered sacrifices to show we're not afraid. We're willing even to offer sacrifices. The king's not going to stop us. He actually gave us his blessings. So it was a way of announcing that we're here and we're here to stay. So one or the other. But either way, there was a fear of the nations around them. And this is important for us to know because, as we know in retrospect, those nations are going to end up being the cause of stopping the work and stopping the rebuilding. So this is a harbinger of what's to come, that these nations are going to cause trouble.
I thought fear was a lack of bitachon. Is that not?
I mean, you know, it was a legitimate fear. And it turned out to be true. I don't know if it's... you think all fear would be a lack of bitachon?
Well, I mean, is it sometimes self-fulfilling prophecy?
Sometimes it can be.
So
sometimes it can be. But I mean, the Torah does say that we're supposed to take whatever is considered to be a proper or normal step in protecting ourselves. So we're not supposed to ignore fear. And that's the story with Gedalia.
Right.
So you have to strike a balance. Pasuk Dalet, verse 4. Vayasu es chag ha-sukos, and they made the holiday of Sukkos. Takasuv, like it says in the Torah. Now, when it means they made it, I mean, the holiday of Sukkot happens by itself. You don't have to make it. But the point is, over here, they brought the sacrifices. For Olas Yom Biyom B'Mispar, they brought up the Ola, the sacrifice of the day, in its day, according to its number, because each day of Sukkot is a different number of sacrifices that are supposed to be brought. Kimishpat Drayom Biyomo, according to the law of each day in its day. The Acharichin, after Sukkot was over, so there are no more holidays for a while. Olas Tamid, they brought up the regular Olas Tamid, the daily sacrifice, Vilech Chodashim, and the sacrifices of Rosh Chodesh, Ulechol Moadei Hashem, HaMekudashim, and all the holidays of Hashem that are sanctified, Ulechol Misnadev Nidavav Hashem, and anybody who would offer a gift to Hashem. If someone wanted to offer an Ola, someone brought an Ola to the Beis HaMikdash, a private carbon, they would do that as well.
Is this the beginning though again? Or were they all, they were just continuing as they left that, they were doing this in Babylonia?
No, they weren't doing this, they couldn't.
So this is all very new.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Gathered together for this.
Yeah.
It's
this
amazing.
This was a major change. They were offering sacrifices for the first time in decades.
And observing the new moon and all of that, right?
Well, they were still observing the new moon. We kept the holidays when we were in Babel. So the new moon was kept. But they weren't able to offer sacrifices.
And the festivals, they all kept all of that. That was a as they left Babylon.
Yeah, whatever they could keep, they kept, unless the Babylonians stopped them. But they kept whatever they could keep. Just like here, we keep whatever we can keep.
Did the other nations give their offerings on the Sukkot?
So, it doesn't seem that that's the case. There was nothing to show the other nations yet. There was no building. It wasn't impressive in any way. And also it appears that the only type of sacrifice that they offered at this time was an Ola, was one that was completely burnt. It does not appear that they offered any other types of sacrifices that require some eating. That, it doesn't seem that they did, and that could have been because of the fact that they had no building of a Beis HaMikdash, and also because they were somewhat impure. Yeah?
Did they not do the Kabbalah for Yom Kippur?
It doesn't say that they did, right? It doesn't mention Rosh Hashanah or Yom Kippur. It starts with Sukkot. So I don't know. I don't know what they did with Yom Kippur. They certainly could not have done everything that it mentions, because many of the kabbalas of Yom Kippur take place in the Beis HaMikdash itself, in the inside.
It's still like, I'm saying, so they didn't do the whole Avodah Siyum either every day.
Right.
So,
right.
I mean, they didn't.
Right, right. But maybe they did some of the Olas. Right, right. That's a good question. I don't know. It only mentions explicitly Sukkot.
And they didn't do the incense offerings. Just
no, because they didn't have that Mizbeach. They couldn't bring that. You need the smaller Mizbeach for that.
And they couldn't build that because they didn't know where it was?
No, because that needs
a need building.
They need a building. That needs a building. It has to be inside the building. Pasuk Vav, verse 6. Miyom Echa Machodesh Hashvi, from the first day of the seventh month, which is Rosh Hashanah, Heichelu Lahalos Olos LaHashem. They began to bring the sacrifice to Hashem. So here, even though we're working backwards a little bit, but it does say explicitly that they did in fact offer karbanos starting with Rosh Hashanah. Heichal Hashem lo yusad, but the heichal, which is the sanctuary, which is the building of Hashem, had not yet been established. It had not yet started to be built. So here the Navi emphasizes for us that only the Mizbeach was up, nothing else. And they were offering sacrifices starting with Rosh Hashanah. Yeah. I don't know how much of it is on a conscious level. The Gemara says many times that an anti-Semite, an anti-Jew, is anti-God.
Mm-hmm.
That it's synonymous.
Mm-hmm.
Because we represent Hashem. Now, I don't know that every anti-Semite consciously is anti-God. But the Gemara seems to be saying that everybody ultimately knows that we represent Hashem. And if they're angry or despise us, it's because they don't want Hashem in their lives. But how much of that is conscious, how much is subconscious, I don't know. Pasuk Zion, verse 7. Vayitnu chesef, they gave money, lachotzvim, to the wood choppers. Actually, excuse me, no, to the...
Quarriers,
it says
here.
What's that?
Quarriers.
Quarriers, right, thank you, that's a good word. So the ones who hewed the rocks. Vilecharashim, and there's the wood people, the carpenters, those who cut the wood. So they paid money for this. Umachol, umishte, and food and drink, vashemen and oil. Latzidonim, vilatzorim. For those people from Tzidon and those people from Tsar, those were non-Jews, but they were experts in, I like that word, quarrying, as opposed to quarreling, quarrying, and in woodworking, and they hired them to lahavi atse arazim min halavanon, to bring the cedar trees from the Lebanon, from Lebanon, el yam yafo, to the ocean of Yafo, because they used the water, they transported. It was a lot easier to use a port and to transport the wood by sea. Kirishyon Koresh Melach Paras Alehem, with the permission of Koresh, the king of Paras, king of Persia, on them. Now this is significant that they hired the Tzidonim and the Tzorim to do this. Shlomo HaMelech did the same thing. Shlomo HaMelech contracted with Hiram Melech Tzor, Hiram the king of Tzor, because his people were experts in how to, I guess, prepare, chop down, etc., the cedar trees that were necessary for building the Beis HaMikdash. That was their area of expertise. And he also contracted with them. However, we're going to see later that the non-Jews are going to offer to participate in the actual building of the Beis HaMikdash. And there the Jews are going to draw the line. That to get to hire them to be part of preparing the materials, that's acceptable. But to actually construct the Beis HaMikdash, that has to be a purely Jewish affair.
Didn't Herod's people do?
Yeah, Herod was in charge. No one could stop him. But he was the king. Here, they're going to reject the help of the non-Jews. So, but at this point, there's no reason to reject it, because at this point it is preparing the materials, it is not the construction itself.
If Cyrus is king of Persia, then Lebanon and all of those, whatever those countries were at the time, were still under his rule.
They just had
trade agreements.
No, they were under his control. I mean, they had to listen to what he said.
Yeah.
I don't know how much the control was, but he was the most powerful king. They couldn't stand up to him.
An epiphany. It's beautiful that they celebrate Sukkot first as a focus, in as we read it, with great joy. Then they went through the soul searching of Rosh Hashanah and the greatness of God. It's beautiful.
Well,
they did that first.
It's only mentioned first. Of course, they kept Rosh Hashanah before Sukkot,
but
it's mentioned
the emphasis first.
Yeah.
It has its awesome meaning.
Yeah, yeah. The reason why it emphasizes here with the permission of Koresh, which is really the whole thing is with the permission of Koresh, so why I emphasize it here is because, and this is another indication that the Levanon was under the control of Koresh, because cedar trees were completely under the purview of the crown. No one was allowed to use the cedar trees for their own purposes. It went for the king's palace, it went for the king's works, whatever as he was having built. You had to have special permission from the crowd. You had to have a permit to harvest cedar trees and use them for your building. So that's why it emphasizes here, it was with the permission of Koresh. This was another thing that could not have been done without his permission. Fazakhez, verse 8. Ubashana Hashenitz, and in the second year, Livoam El Beis Elokim Yerushalayim, from the time they came to the house of Hashem in Yerushalayim, again it means the place of the house of Hashem, since there was no house yet. Bachodesh Hasheni, in the second month, which is Iyar, so the second year, second month, so we're talking now 7 months after they first established the Mizbeach, because that was in Tishrei, and this is 7 months later. Hechelu Zerubbabel ben Shealtiel v'Yeshua ben Yotzadok. Zerubbabel, and this is Yeshua Kongadol, they began And who else began? Ushaar Achayim Hakanim VaLevim, and the rest of their brothers, the Kanim and the Levim. V'chol Haboim MeHashavi Yerushalayim, and all those who came from the having been taken captive when they went to Babel. Now they return to Yerushalayim. Vayamidu es haLevim, and they established or they stood up the Levim miben Esrim Shana v'Mala, from 20 years and up. Linatseach Amaleches Beis Hashem to Linatseach means to conduct, which means to sing and play instruments concerning the malacha, the work of building the house of Hashem. So in the second month is when the building really started to be in earnest, because until then they were preparing the materials. They weren't able to actually build, of course, until they had the materials that were necessary. They needed the stones, they needed the wood, and that took some time. But now, maybe they excavated, but now they're ready to start, so, or at least ready to start in earnest. So now they not only built, but the Levim sang and played instruments during the building. So that's an interesting thing. They're taking able-bodied men who could have been involved in the building, and they put them around the building site to play instruments and sing while they are building. So imagine the scene. You know, you think of a construction site, you know, and you see people working and all that, and you know, and sometimes you'll have blaring music, like rock music going on, because that's what they like listening to. So imagine a construction site with people in their overalls, and they're, you know, and they're dirty, because they're clean, and you have the Levium on the periphery. Wow. With their instruments and with their music, and they're singing. And what are they singing? We'll see in a minute what they sang. Vayamo Yeshua banav ve'echav, and Yeshua and his sons and his brothers got up. Kadmiel, and also Kadmiel is another person. Ubanav and his sons, Bnei Yehuda ke'echad, the children of Yehuda as one. So it wasn't that you have people of Yehuda here as well. Linatseach ala oseam alacha beveso alokim, to conduct, which means to play music and to sing, for those who are doing the work of the house of Hashem. Bnei Chenadad, the children of Chenadad, Bnehem v'Achehem haLevim, their children and their brothers, the Levim. So let me just say as an aside, in the Beis HaMikdash, of course, we know only the Levim are able to sing. What about playing instruments? Could a non-Levi play an instrument? If there's someone who is very good with various instruments, does it have to be a Levi? This is a source of debate. Most of the opinions hold that a non-Levi could play an instrument in the Beis HaMikdash. Only the Levim were able to sing, but the instruments could be played possibly by others, even though, of course, it was primarily Levim that did it. That is, according to some opinions. Other opinions hold that no, only the Levim could play instruments. However, bear in mind that here, this was not the same thing, because this was not singing and playing instruments during the service of the Beis HaMikdash. It is called malacha, which is work, but here it was in the construction of the Beis HaMikdash, not the service of the Beis HaMikdash. So it's a little different over here, and presumably you wouldn't have the same restrictions in this playing of instruments that they will have when the Beis HaMikdash is really completed. Yeah?
Do you think that if some of us have like musical talents, there might be some levying
I don't know. I don't know. My father used to tell me that he never knew a levy that couldn't carry a tune. But later, as we've already mentioned in this class, there were not all Levim were singers. It depended on their family. Some of them were singers and some of them were gatekeepers, and you couldn't do the other job. Mm-hmm. So I don't know.
Was that the only two jobs then? The singers, the instruments, and the gatekeepers?
In the time of the Mishkan, they also carried all the parts of the Beis HaMikdash, of the Mishkan, but that no longer happened in the time of the Beis HaMikdash.
They're called the gatekeepers, the one who carried all the...
No, they all carried, it seems. They all carried. The gatekeepers were the ones who opened and closed the gates and guarded.
Oh.
You know, they were the ticket takers. Oh. You know.
Yeah. So the singing men that came with them, are those the Levium? Because there was also singing women. What happened to those singing women?
Yeah, so the singing women would not have been present, wouldn't have been singing at the construction site, because presumably it was the men who were doing the construction, I imagine. But but there were singing women on their way up from Bava.
Right, and the singing men, were they all Levium?
I don't think they had to be. They certainly didn't have to be all Levium. It was probably predominantly Levium, but I imagine that it was anybody who was good at singing.
Who brought the food if the women were there?
I'm sure there were women who brought the, I'm sure that that happened. But I'm saying, but the actual...
Men are not cooking.
I imagine the men were not cooking. Yeah. But the ones who were doing the work itself, who were doing the, you know, the actual, you know, the hard labor,
yeah.
I imagine that was all men.
The singing followed
Yeah, so we're about to see. So what we're going to get to, it's very interesting what they sang. This is what I mean. We have to just keep in mind a modern-day construction site and then compare it to this. It's an incredible thing. So let's go a little further. V'yisdu abonim es heichal Hashem, and the builders established they made the foundation of the sanctuary. Thank you, Hashem. Vayamidu akonim milubashim, and they stood up the kohanim who were they established the kohanim who were dressed. It doesn't say what they were dressed in. That they were dressed, which obviously they were all dressed, but it was dressed in something special. And the kohanim were stood up bachat sotzros with their trumpets. As we know, the kohanim would blow trumpets in the Beis Hamikdash, and here the kohanim had their trumpets. Vayalevim b'nei asaf. Ba-mit-sil tayim, and the Levim, the children of Asaf, had their mit-sil tayim, which was a type of instrument.
It says cymbal.
Yeah, so they say cymbal, but I don't know if it really means cymbal, like cymbal. Because how talented do you have to be to do a cymbal? You have to be able to keep a beat, right? But I don't know that Asaf and his children are reputed to have been incredible musicians. So I wonder if
it's...
Finger?
I don't know.
Cymbal?
I don't know what it was.
Percussion too.
Maybe it was percussion, but it was something more complicated. It wasn't something that you know anybody can do. And what do? Lehallel es Hashem, to praise Hashem, al yedei David Melech Yisrael, using the words of David, the king of Israel, which of course is, as Mrs. Kaiser just said, Tehillim. They were singing Tehillim. Vayanu, and they called out behallel with praise uvehodos and with thanks for Hashem ki tov. Ki le'olam chasdo al Yisrael, for he is good, for forever is his kindness on the Jews. That's what they were singing. They were singing praises to Hashem about the kindness of Hashem. V'chol ha'am he'riu serua gedola, and all the nation they let out a tremendous trua is with the blowing of the trumpets or calling out behalel Hashem, with praise to Hashem al husad beis Hashem, on the pouring of the foundation. I don't think they poured concrete, but on the laying of the foundation of the house of Hashem. So as they were putting down the foundation, when they put up the Mizbeach, that didn't cause this incredible joy of singing and all that, because that was like, it was makeshift, it wasn't gorgeous, it was just get it done quickly, let's get those sacrifices started. But when they actually put down the foundation, or as they're putting down the foundation of that Beis HaMikdash itself, they're putting down the stones, they're putting in the wood, they're really establishing the Beis HaMikdash itself, then you have this outpouring of praise and thanks to Hashem. And you have this singing going on of the Levim, the trumpets, the Kohanim, and everything. The Kohanim, what they wore at this time is a debate, whether they wore priestly garments, Kohanim garments, which would suggest that they could wear those garments for something of this nature. They couldn't just wear the garments just because they felt like it. There had to be some sort of Beis HaMikdash type job in order to wear the garments. So that's one possibility. And another opinion is that they did not wear those garments, because you could only wear those garments when dealing with the sacrifices themselves. But here, while they were building, the Kohanim wore a special garment that was specifically made for this purpose. That people, like we said before, that they were donated special garments for Kohanim to wear at this time. That would be a possibility as well. Yud Beis 12, V'rabim me'akohanim v'alevim, and many of the Kohanim and the Levim, v'rashi ha'avos hazakenim, and the heads of the families, the elders, asheru es habayis harishon biyasto, that saw the first Beis HaMikdash when it was established. Now it doesn't mean that they saw it when it was first established, which would have been almost 500 years earlier. But it means they had seen the first Beis HaMikdash in its building when it was still up. Zeh HaBayis Be'eneihem, this house in their eyes, this new house comparatively caused them bochim b'kol gadol, were crying, were wailing in a loud voice. V'rabim b'sruah b'simcha l'harim kol, and there were many who were calling out and in joy with loud voices. So you had competing voices. Everybody was loud. Either the rejoicers, the ones who had not seen the first Beis HaMikdash, the youngins, they were rejoicing, singing, praising Hashem. Because imagine, all they knew was Bavel. They didn't know from the Beis HaMikdash. They never seen a Beis HaMikdash before. How are we going to feel when the Beis HaMikdash is rebuilt? All right? We've never seen a Beis HaMikdash. All we're going to do is sing and dance. And what else are we going to do? So the younger generation, they were singing and they were praising. But the older generation that had seen what had come before, they were also very loud and they were wailing. They were wailing and crying. And as the next pasuk says, Ve'ein ha'am makirim kol truas ha'simcha, and the nation could not recognize the sound of the calling out of the joy, l'kol b'chi ha'am, because of the sound of the crying of the nation. The crying was even louder than the joy. Ki ha'am miriim trua gedola, for the nation was calling out a great teruah, a great calling out, that's in joy. V'hakol nishma, but the sound of the crying was heard ad lemei rachok, until very far away. It was even louder. The sad cries was louder than the joyous cries. So we have this dichotomy that's going on. Everybody is here. Those who came up, we're talking about people who came up to rebuild the Beis HaMikdash, including the older generation. They came. And you have over 40,000 people here involved in the building of the Beis HaMikdash. But when they actually started to put down the foundation, then, the younger generation were just ecstatic. But the older generation, when they saw what was being done, until then it wasn't clear what it was going to look like. But once they saw what was being done, it harkened back to what was, and they realized that what's going to be now is going to be a shadow of what had come before. And it was a shadow of what had come before. The second Beis HaMikdash was a wonderful thing. And anybody who had not seen the first Beis HaMikdash, it was unbelievable. And believe me, I mean, we all know this, we'd much rather have that than have nothing. But the first Beis HaMikdash was much greater. It was much greater. Its spirituality was greater. There were miracles that took place there that did not take place in the second Beis HaMikdash. They had, as we said, the Aron, the Ark. They had things that they didn't have in the second Beis HaMikdash. It was with our own king, which we didn't have in the second Beis HaMikdash. There were many things that were diminished in the second Beis HaMikdash. And the older generation could not hold back. They couldn't withstand the sadness that it conjured up to see this compared to what was. We of course don't have a context like this, because as I said, when the Beis HaMikdash is rebuilt speedily in our days, we're all going to be ecstatic. What else are we going to do? But and it also will be greater, right? But right.
For joy. But with the crying of joy, I mean, you couldn't contain yourself.
Yeah, it'll be joyous. It won't be out of sadness. But what it does remind me of is when Torah was reestablished in America after the destruction of Torah in Europe. Whatever went on in Europe before the war, you have eyewitnesses who report different things. So you can hear different reports about it, about the greatness that was, about the things that weren't so great that was. There were different things that went on in Europe before the war. But it is clear that the scholarship in Torah before the war, before World War II, in Europe, was well beyond what we are aware of, what we've come in contact with today. Even though the numbers of people studying Torah, both in Israel and here, today, the world over, exceeds the numbers that study Torah possibly since the second Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, possibly. The amount of people studying Torah today is immense. but the scholarship of the people studying Torah is far diminished. Is far diminished. The eyewitnesses will tell you that the way that they knew what they had learned, the ability to repeat by heart all of the Gemara, all of Shas, all of the different commentaries over there, the legendary pin test. You know what a pin test is?
Mm-hmm.
The legendary pin test is you take a pin and you turn to the first page of whatever Gemara you have in front of you, and you take the pin and you stick it in over here, and then you say, okay, right over here where the pin I just stuck through, what word does it go through on page 56?
Yeah.
And the person will tell you, well, it's the word is, you know, is Devarim, and you turn there and it's Devarim, and it goes right through over. That's the pin test. My grandfather, told me that his father was able to take the pin test on Shulchan Aruch, on the code of Jewish law, not on Gemara, but on the code of Jewish law. But so that's an amazing thing. But it wasn't that amazing, meaning that a lot of people were able to do that. The scholarship was unbelievable before the war. For those who studied, it was an incredible scholarship. They didn't have the distractions that we have. Those who learned. That was it. And they really knew it. When Torah was reestablished on these shores, and we had the great sages that were in the previous generations of Rav Aaron Cutler, Rav Moshe Feinstein, Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, the real big ones that were here in the previous generations, they knew what was in Europe. They had been there, and they knew greatness. And when people here said about them that their scholarship was incredible, and it was incredible, it was unbelievable, their scholarship, they knew that what they're being praised for, it pales in comparison to what they had seen in Europe. And for them, it was very painful. It was painful because to be held up as the picture of scholarship when you know that what you came from exceeded what you have, it's very, very painful. That means that there's a significant drop in what had happened. Even though, from our perspective, these people were just giants. And it could be that they were as great as those who came before them, but there were so many more.
Mm-hmm.
There were so many more in Europe.
What do you suppose is the lifting up or the
connecting? Right. So you're right that the only way for the Beis HaMikdash to be rebuilt is going to be with connecting to Hashem, and that it will lead to the next thing. The one thing that we have that nobody had before us is that Torah in America and even in Israel started from scratch. We didn't have anything. Post World War II, we really started from scratch. There was not much. Hashem saved some people out of the war to reestablish Torah, but it was starting from scratch. So everything that we do is taken by Hashem in that context. So it can be that what we're doing is much more meaningful because we're coming from so little. So everything that we do is that much greater. In that way, that's the way I always think about it. That in that way, we do have an advantage, and hopefully that will lead to...
That will
trigger getting closer and closer to Hashem. But I do know that the eyewitnesses do report much greater scholarship before World War II in Europe than we have here.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to torahmediaatlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.